Dear listener, before we start today's episode, I want to tell you about a resource I've created, which I want to share with you for free. I'll tell you what it is and how to get it. If you're not already writing tests for your Rails code, you're probably aware that testing can help you ship your work faster and with fewer defects. Because testing is such an in-demand skill, but since so few developers know how to do it properly, I've created a resource for you called The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing. This guide is a short, downloadable book which answers the most common Rails testing questions that beginners tend to have, including, which testing framework should I use, RSpec or Minitest? What level of test coverage should I shoot for? What are the different kinds of Rails tests? What are all the Rails testing tools, and how do I use them? My guide covers these questions and several others. To get the Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing, go to railstestingguide.com. Now on to the episode. Today I'm here with Kevin Murphy, software developer at The NAR Company. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
Thanks for being here. What is The NAR Company?
Sure. So we're a software consultancy, largely based out of Boston, Massachusetts, but with the world today, all over.
Yeah. Okay. And what you and I are going to be talking about today is the topic of your recent RailsConf talk. Can you tell us a little bit about what your talk was?
Sure. So the title of the talk was Engineering MBA. And essentially, it's talking about the parts of an MBA curriculum from business school that might be applicable for software developers in their day-to-day work.
Okay. So what are some of those things?
Sure. So I guess the first thing I talk about is this model called situational leadership, which is a way of how to model how you interact with other people, essentially. And it proposes that there are four different leadership styles, depending on how much help someone needs and how much relationship or like a political help someone needs at a given task. And the biggest importance takeaway from there is that ultimately it proposes there are four different styles, but really to be successful, you need to be able to model all four of those. And the difficulty comes in knowing when to apply each style. You know, okay. So if you're someone that is always just like, all right, Jason, here's what we're going to do. We're going to add a link to the page. It's going to say, click here to download the podcast. And, it's going to be an A tag or a link to in Rails, and that's what we're going to do. That might be great if someone isn't familiar with Rails. It's their first part, first task on a new team. But if you go into that minute detail with someone who's very familiar or has done this a lot, it's going to sound like micromanaging, and they're going to feel maybe disrespected and maybe a little put off. And also, it's just not worth anyone's time to do that. But knowing when to apply certain scenarios or certain leadership styles in the scenario is really the crucial part of that model.
Okay. And what are the four leadership styles?
Yeah. So the first is directing. And that's most like the example I gave before of like very clearly just stating, here's a checklist of everything we need to do. Now you go forward and just do it. Right. The second is coaching. And in coaching, we start to talk more about giving people some more background and context, maybe explaining like why this process is this way, getting some feedback from them about how we can better incorporate the work going forward. But still, the person, quote unquote, leading is in charge of the decision making still. That flips when we move into supporting, at which point the leader is saying, hey, you go ahead and make the decision. And it's my role right now to make sure that you have the tools that you need. and have consistent check-ins to make sure you're talking with the right people. But you are afforded the authority and ability to go forward and decide how this work is done. And the last style is delegating, which is essentially get out of the person's way. They're an expert or they know what they're doing. Let them go forward and be awesome.
Okay. And are these things mostly applicable for people who are in some sort of leadership position, or can this knowledge be helpful to somebody who is not in an official leadership position?
Absolutely. So obviously, given the name of it and given what we're talking about, it sounds like, oh, well, this doesn't matter to me because I'm not an engineering lead or I'm not an engineering manager. But, you know, whether you're bestowed it by title or not, everyone has opportunities to exude leadership qualities and flex those muscles. The most obvious or maybe standard one that I talk about in the talk that everyone can have an opportunity to flex these muscles is in sprint planning with a team, right? Where you can still work, you can be working with your team members and understand what sort of support that they need, either from you or from the team or from leadership, and can use this model to understand, at the very least, here's what leadership I need right now, because I understand that I'm in this scenario, and or provide that leadership to others in an informal basis, because you're all part of a team and you're all helping each other out.
Yeah. I've thought about this a little bit before, like, you can serve in a leadership role in an organization, even if your job isn't explicitly a leadership job. And sometimes there's kind of a leadership vacuum, not necessarily because somebody in leadership isn't doing their job or anything like that, although maybe sometimes, but like sometimes you're just working on a team and maybe the rest of the team is fairly junior, or they just have like weaknesses in certain areas that you have a strength in, or whatever the case may be. I'll give a quick example from my experience. At the last job I worked at, we kind of shuffled around a couple times, and so I had the opportunity to work on a couple different teams. But a lot of the time when we were doing our sprint planning, the sprint planning, frankly, didn't go that good. And so I offered some help there. The main thing that we would do badly in the sprint planning is that we would just bite off way too much stuff. And so I was always the kind of the voice being like, hey guys, we have this historical velocity of not very much, and now we're trying to take on all this stuff for this sprint. Why do you guys think that'll work? And kind of being that, I called myself the voice of pessimism and doom, because that was just kind of the role I took on. And as a result of me doing that, somebody, I don't know who exactly it was, maybe it was the project manager who was involved. The project manager at least was the person to tell me that they decided me to give me the position of scrum master for that team, so that I could more officially help in that role. And then I had to figure out, like, okay, what's a scrum master?
Right. Did you get your certification?
No, I didn't. Probably never will. But like, that was a good example of like just taking the leadership that needed to be done and just doing it. And then as a result, I was officially given that leadership.
Yeah, and that can be super helpful in situations where that exists. It doesn't have to be that daunting if you don't feel comfortable doing that yourself either, right? Because a part of that is just personality. But as a member of a team, there's, as much as we all like to think, oh, we're all equally aware of all areas of our code base and we spread work around, there is a reality of just like, oh, Alice, if you're dealing with payments, Alice is the person that knows everything about payments. Oh, there's a payments ticket. Let's have Alice work on it. And like, that can be important and helpful and impactful if there's like, payments aren't working right now, everything's broken, please, Alice, fix it. But it's also important to know if you are Alice or if you're working with Alice, that if there's not a mission critical situation, this is a great opportunity to have Alice work with someone else to then help share that experience and work through, understanding. And again, this is where like going back to situational leadership can understand like, oh, Alice is someone I can just delegate work to. But it also means that Alice has an immense ability and power to be able to help someone that might know nothing about payments and help work them through to get to that level of confidence with payments that Alice has. So as you're doing that planning effort, understanding, like, I'm going to intentionally, not necessarily not put Alice on this, but put Alice on it with someone else so they can work together and get more of an understanding of more of our code base, more of the application, maybe new technologies. And then we have a better, more well-rounded team and Alice can actually take vacation. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So I know we like went over them, but I don't remember them. And probably the listener doesn't remember either. Can we just go over real quick those four leadership styles again?
Absolutely. So the first one is directing. And directing is effective when someone needs a lot of help on the actual task work at hand and maybe doesn't need to know a lot of like the backstory and context. So like if you're writing a ticket, it would like, you know, if whatever ticketing system you might use, like Jira or Trello or just a post-it note or whatever, right? Someone benefiting from a directing style might just need it like written out of just like a checklist of like do these seven things and then the task is done. And like now, they can just follow the checklist mm-hmm. and go for it.
I remember the other one, coaching.
Yes, that is the next one. Yep. And then in coaching, maybe it's like maybe the person's done something very similar to this before, but it has like a subtle nuance. And we can work with them to say like, hey, let's talk afterwards about how this is related to that thing you were working on before. I'll help you figure out, you know, the way we're going to actually implement this. And then provide you more information about like, you know, okay, so like the reason we use payment provider X is because Y. And, you know, we have, you know, some leeway here and there. I'm going to keep going back to the payments example just because I locked myself in that corner. And so coaching, again, still like the person doing the quote unquote leading still ultimately has the decision making authority or burden, depending on how you look at it. But they're giving more information and taking in more information from the rest of the team to prepare them to be able to be more comfortable, to be able to make decisions for themselves. And in the other two styles, that's when the team or individual is the one making decisions. And the leader's role is to support and facilitate that work and make sure that they have what they need.
Got it.
The first one being supporting, which is more like, so this is like sort of an introduction. So they might need more information about like who the players are, right? Just even knowing like who the right people are to talk to. Not because you've intentionally shielded them from things, but like that's just the way the world works sometimes, right? And then checking in on them and making sure like, hey, did you talk to that person? How did it go? Do you need some help? You know, are we on the right path here? You know, just being mindful of what their needs are. And then the last one, delegating, is like I said, the sort of like the best way I put it is just like, please, leaders, get out of their way. Like, they know what they're doing.
Got it. Yeah. And maybe the supporting, that might be a case where, like, the person in the leadership position might not have the particular technical expertise, for example, to make a decision. And so somebody else needs to make that decision, and then the person in leadership supports that person.
Sure. Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. And was your talk mainly focused, your RailsConf talk, was it mainly focused on those four leadership styles, or were there other points to it?
Yeah. So I broke it down to three different, I called them courses because I did a faux like, hey, we're going back to college thing. And situational leadership was one of them. The other two were competitive advantage and process management. Just to give you a bit of a heads up of where we're going.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell us about those.
Sure. So competitive advantage is ultimately like at a very general sense, how you as a business will be successful in the marketplace. And there are a couple of generically applicable strategies that you can use to develop a competitive advantage. So we're going to go into a list of lists now. and the first one I talk about is cost. And that's hopefully pretty much on its face, like that's just being the lowest cost provider, right? You're the cheapest option. So your advantage is people are going to come use your product because it costs $7 to use yours and anything else in the market costs $9. And who has $2 to throw around when I can be
Sorry,
saving it?
Before we go deeper into this, I want to ask like, what level should I be thinking about this? Like, is this competitive advantage? Like, I'm a developer working at a company and I'm thinking about their competitive advantage, or I'm thinking about my own competitive advantage as a developer competing with other developers for jobs, or like, how should I be thinking about that?
Sure. So I will answer it by not answering it and say you can think about it in either perspective, because for better or worse, as an individual, you are also out there on the marketplace for jobs. So this can be very helpful to determine how you're going to position yourself if you're looking for a new role. This can also help you just better understand, like, hey, how does the company I work for make money? Right? Like, why do people even like work with us? Right? Like, is it that our thing costs $7 and everyone else costs $9? Or is it that it's better than everyone else's? Or like, we have really good marketing and people have heard of us, or whatever other things you might have. Ultimately, from a developer perspective, I think the biggest advantage to understanding this comes into making a decision on how to implement a certain feature. So I talk in the talk about like a build versus buy decision, right? Which is like sort of like a classic, like, oh, do we build out this custom feature for feature flagging, or do we pay whatever service to do feature flagging for us, and they have an API and we use it, and instead we give them money, right? If you understand how you as an organization make your money and what your core competencies are, like what you are really good at, what you are best at, and what you strive to bring to the marketplace that others can't, it can help make that decision easier, right? Like if you're, you know, this is maybe a too obvious example, but if you're a feature flag company and you're going to then use another feature flag service to do the feature flagging thing you need in your app, you might want to think long and hard about why you're in business.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's like the like most obvious example where like the Venn diagram is just an overlap. Right. But if you're, you know, if you're a blogging platform, then, you know, you maybe don't want to spend your time building a feature flagging service because you want to spend your time building features that are going to enhance the blogging platform. And so you can either throw a lot of engineering and development resources at building out this feature flagging feature, or you can rely on someone whose business literally does depend on being a great feature flag provider.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. And that's the competitive, what was the heading or whatever? Competitive, what was
competitive advantage.
Competitive advantage. Okay.
Yep.
And was there more to the competitive advantage, or is that pretty much the gist of it?
I mean, that's a lot of the gist of it. The other strategies are differentiation, which is just doing something differently in the marketplace, right? We already talked about cost. So differentiation, you know, you might have a feature that other competitors don't have. You might just do something differently or better, right? Your product might straight up just be better on whatever, you know, axis by which you determine that.
You know, here's a question for you. So I have a job, and for the last 2.5 years, I've had just a regular full-time job. But before that, I was a freelancer for like 8 years. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to always like move up in terms of value.
Yep.
And I wanted to be not just a coder who would like implement somebody else's instructions, but an actual like valuable consultant who could provide business input and stuff like that. And what I discovered with a depressingly high degree of confidence is that nobody ever wants to hear the developer's opinion about business stuff. And I'm trying to think if there are like any exceptions that I've ever encountered, and I don't think there have been. Like just nobody is interested. And so I'm curious if your experience has been any different. Like if a developer learns this like businessy kind of stuff, is the usefulness limited to maybe like a level of understanding, or maybe you can kind of like covertly be helpful in these ways? Or do you have experience where that's different from my experience, where somebody in leadership does actually care about what you have to say regarding business matters?
Sure. So I guess I'll sort of deconstruct that piece by piece. And I will say that like at the base level, just understanding more about the world, particularly the world that you're working in, hopefully has a benefit for just knowing like, oh, that's why the boss made that decision. I can understand that now. I may not agree with it. I may not have any input in it, but like I get where they're coming from. Like, they want to save money, or like, oh, we need to roll out this new feature because we've got this, you know, trade show coming up and we've got to announce XYZ thing because we got to, you know, get some people using our new app or whatever. Like, I get it. Okay, cool. And then from there beyond, then you can start to understand, like, and again, I don't want to make this sound like seedy or like doing an end run around, but like you can understand what levers to push and press in your organization that will provide benefit. Right. So like the easiest one that hopefully everyone like can appreciate is just like, hey, we estimate that building this feature flag functionality is going to cost us 6 months. And given, you know, developer salaries, you're going to burn through however many dollars that's going to cost. Right. Or we can give such and such a company $12 a month. And I don't know how much feature flagging costs, so I'm sorry, feature flag companies, if I've dramatically over or undervalued you. And then you can do some analysis of just like, that means that we'll break even after 6 months, a year, 3 years. Assuming everything's stale and stagnant, but that's not true. We're still going to have to maintain that code. We're going to be on the hook for dealing with all that stuff. Is that something that we want to invest in as an organization? Or is that something that we want to rely on someone else to deal with? Now, with the additional caveat that we always talk about as developers of like the trouble with dependencies, right? Sometimes they go away. Sometimes they start not working the way we wanted them to. Sometimes they never worked how we wanted them to do, but we thought like, oh, we can make it work, right? And so there's a level of risk there. And risk appetite is a huge part of understanding a lot of business decisions too, right? To just know like, oh, this person, you know, not politically, but just the way they operate is like relatively conservative. And like, they're very concerned about making sure that like, you know, we keep payroll going and the company afloat and like keeping as much, you know, money as they possibly want. Or someone might be more risky and say like, oh, we've got this big VC influx of cash. So like, let's go on a spending party, which, you know, isn't necessarily always driven by circumstances, sometimes by just people's personality and leadership and how they like to operate. But once you have a framing of understanding what those things are in your organization, then you can help lead people either to where you want to go or have a conversation with folks in terms and understanding that will be impactful to them, right? So like, they might not care about, hey, we want to do this like refactor because it's going to be awesome, right? But they might care about it because like, hey, if we do this refactor, that levels up our organization to have a better understanding of how this critical piece of infrastructure works. It brings it up to speed with current standards. It then means we can develop features quicker, and also we have less risk because we're going to fix this security vulnerability or you know, other things that actually like quote unquote matter to folks, right? So like, how you sell things can be informed by having this understanding.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting. I've spent, you know, since like 2008, I first in 2008 started trying to build some kind of online business. And so starting around that time, I started to learn about business and marketing and all that kind of stuff. And it's taken me down some interesting like side trails. And one of those was like the topic of persuasiveness. Mm-hmm. Because like, When you're, I don't know, for example, when you're selling a product, you have to lay out the case for why somebody should want the product. And you have to, you know, it's not persuasiveness in the sense of like trying to persuade somebody to do something that they really don't want to do or really shouldn't do. But it's like, if you're actually like the exact perfect person to buy this product and you really actually should buy it, you have to make the case for why that's the case. And so I've read a couple books on persuasion, and then also like just in your day-to-day existence, like your satisfaction in life is a lot of the times determined by your effectiveness in getting other people to do what you want. Again, not in like a manipulative way, but it's like, if there's something that, well, here's an example. If a doctor prescribes some medication to a patient, that doctor is going to need to persuade that patient to actually take the medication properly. because it really is the best thing for the patient. And so this goes back to something you were saying, reminded me of it. Oh yeah, like these kind of options for like, we can do this and spend this much and build it ourselves, or we can like get some off the shelf $12 a month feature flag package, whatever. What I often like to do as a persuasive technique when I'm laying out those kinds of things is I basically will never say, I think we should do X. Instead, I'll say, we have this fork in the road. We can, the options as I see them are A, B, and C. And here's the pros and cons for each of those things. And then based on that, my recommendation would be option B. And I find that, well, I don't know if I can really tell how successful or not I have been with that, but I feel like it works. And I feel like generally I get my way more of the time than if I just say, hey, we have this problem and I think we should do this. Let's do this. Human nature is to resist that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I guess something I'll add to that, like pros and cons list, and then coming to a recommendation that can help further it sometimes is talking about like, here's how it applies in this particular scenario, and like, here are the criteria I use to consider the importance of these pros and cons. And based off of that, you know, we decided like, oh, we're really cash strapped, so it's really important that we worry about how much things cost. Or like, you know, this is a compliance issue, so like, it kind of doesn't matter how much it costs. Like, we got to make sure that the, you know, whatever regulatory body doesn't come down hard on us. So therefore, we want to do the best, most important thing, because it's like our livelihood literally depends upon it, right? And then being able to appropriately communicate those things like helps engender some trust and understanding of just like, oh yeah, like, there is an understanding that like, there are real serious consequences here, and this person's thought through the impact there, not just like, oh, I want to use like, you know, this, you know, fun new toy product that just came out, but like, there actually like is an importance here, and there's an understanding there.
Yeah, and to me, one of the key things is making the other person feel like they're the one making the decision.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so let's see. We talked about competitive advantage, and then you had like a third high point, right?
Yeah, so the last one was process management, which is an incredibly highfalutin word for the scientific method. but it's essentially how organizations handle how they do everything they do on a daily basis, right? Whether it's, you know, accounts receivable, accounts payable, or your marketing, or, you know, whatever your business domain is, the different steps that you follow and how you can continually improve upon those. And now, as developers, whether we call it that or not, we all have processes that we follow and therefore can manage. And sometimes to a fault, right, of like people like spending forever trying to get their Vim RC to be like exactly perfect. And like, I'm going to type the fewest number of keystrokes possible, and all it's going to take me is 7 years of research to get there. Right. And like, that can be helpful and valuable over a period of time, but people can overdo it. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, I have a huge list of aliases and stuff that I used to, but and just, you know, think of the microseconds that I've saved over the course of my career by, you know, typing one character as opposed to three.
Well, that's just, you know, the Vim lifestyle. It's the way to go.
Exactly. Exactly. But it's important to be able to know, like, hey, if I'm going to actually make a change, like, how do I actually know that, like, it worked? Right? Like I took this new shortcut on, and like, did it actually make my life better? I don't know.
You're talking about changes to process and measuring their effectiveness.
Okay. Exactly. Exactly. You know, so like the actual like process that you go into with process management is one of first just understanding where you are currently, right? Because like that sounds silly, but like actually having it written out sometimes can be difficult. Like, people don't actually know, like, oh, how do we actually collect money from customers, right? Like, actually having that written out can be incredibly valuable, because you might unearth a bunch of understandings that you didn't even know about, right? Like, oh, we have a whole thing that someone has to submit paperwork to that like then goes to someone's desk that then they have to approve. Like, that's news to me. I thought it just went in the computer, right? But if you don't know, if you haven't gone through that exercise and know that, then you're sort of in the dark, and you can guess and make things up. And you might be right, but I'm not a good guesser.
Yeah, it's obviously better to know things than to just guess.
And then from there, once you know about it, then it's you know, making a calculated bet. And before actually doing it, understanding what impact it might have by doing some, you know, the sort of like nth degree of this is doing like statistical modeling and actually like, you know, developing a hypothesis, and then before doing it for real, like doing some, you know, modeling and statistical math to determine like, is this actually going to be good or not? And like, that's incredibly important in like capital E engineering things, or like in facilities that are like, you know, doing manufacturing, where it's like, it wouldn't be feasible to just go ahead and like, just go ahead and change and estimate how we build cars and like completely redo our factory. Right. Which is a benefit we have a lot as software developers. We can just make the change, and if it doesn't work, like, we can throw it away. It's just bits on a computer, right? But if you're actually laying out a factory, it's really hard to do that and then change it after. So you've got to do some work up front to understand, like, this is actually probably a good idea.
Yeah. Cause and effect can sometimes be really hard to determine. Because, like, you know, I think programmers are spoiled in a certain sense, which is our work involves a lot of really tight feedback loops. Yep. And we can try something and see within seconds or less whether something works or not. And so then there's other things like longer running processes, and it's not as easy to see the impact of changes. And sometimes people get confused about cause and effect. Like, I've asked people this question before, like, okay, imagine this hypothetical scenario where you have this order page and you measure it over time, and in the month of March, the conversion rate is 1%. And the background of the order page is blue. And then in April, you change the background from blue to red, and in April, the conversion rate is 1.5% instead of 1% like it was in March. Now, what caused the conversion rate to go up?
Right. I mean, it could be any number of things, right? It could be that color. It could be I'm selling Easter candy, and Easter's in April this year, and then more people want to buy Easter candy from me, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the answer is that you don't know, because like, right. In order to do that test in a truly scientific way, you'd have to have two universes, one universe where it's blue and another universe where it's red, and nothing else in that universe is different. Exactly. But instead, so many things are different. Like, the simple fact that it's a different month is a huge difference because of like the seasonal nature of like everything. Yep. And yeah, you really just can't know. And so I don't know if developers are particularly susceptible to mistakes like that, but in general, it's like a trait of humanity that you see something happen, and then after that, you see something happen, and we infer causality based on the sequence. But that is, you know, the saying that everybody repeats over and over, that correlation is not causation, but the lesson hasn't really sunk in for everybody.
Yeah, people can be very good at finding patterns that may or may not actually exist, right? Or may or may not be patterns for the reason they think they are. And quite frankly, it's hard, right? Like, how do we know? We can't. Like you said, we don't have two competing universes that are exactly the same except for this one variable. So unfortunately, sometimes we have to make a leap of faith and take a bit of an inference. And we might have to walk that back afterwards once we have more information.
Yeah, and another thing is, like, maybe you can't measure things on a micro level, but you can on a macro level. Like, for example, we've been making some changes over the last few days to our development process. And there's not really anything that I can measure. Well, like, it was suggested to me to observe things over the next couple days and see if our stories seem to be completed faster than in the past. But I don't think that's really valid, because if these stories happen to be completed quickly, what does that mean? Maybe it means that our change caused that effect, but maybe it just means that these stories happen to be smaller, or maybe maybe it's anything else, who knows? And so that's just not enough data. But we can like observe over the next couple months, how many things do we finish per sprint? And if that number goes up, then maybe, not even certainly yet, but like maybe that was the cause. So sometimes you can't measure those really fine-grained things, but you can measure the big picture.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, estimation is hard. And if we were right every time, we would call it actuals and not estimation. And you've got to take that longer view to understand where you're coming from. And then you can tease out things like seasonality or, you know, any other random effects of the universe, right? Of how close the sun was to Earth today versus yesterday. And, you know, the effect that the moon might have on the tide pool and that make you more productive as a developer. You know, those things are incredibly difficult to tease out at very small scales. And obviously I'm just using farcical examples, but and that can be difficult with your, if you're working in a team that doesn't have a lot of that history built up, right? So like that happens a lot with us. We're like, you know, obviously we're a consulting firm, so we'll come in and help people for a very short period of time, right? And even before we start work, there's a huge amount of estimation work that goes into that, right? How long is this engagement going to take? How many people are going to need? What's our level of involvement? And we can rely on past projects that are similar, but nothing's exactly the same, right? And we got to be really upfront and clear about that. And, you know, hopefully everything takes less time, right? Hopefully everything's quicker. And we're not intentionally telling people like, hey, things are going to take twice as long as we think they are. Like, no, we're extremely clear about like, based on past projects, we think it'll be about this. Here are the risks, here are the variables. And, you know, based on our best understanding, here's where we're at. But I think the communication can help there a lot, of just like setting expectations as opposed to just being like, yep, this is going to take 2 weeks. Don't worry about it. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks. It'll be done.
Yeah. Yeah. Estimation is obviously difficult. I read, it's like this Microsoft book, Software Estimation, Demystifying the Dark Art. And that contained a really important lesson for me, which is basically like, if you want to estimate something, basically measure your historical, it didn't use these terms, but like measure your historical velocity and use that as a projection. Because if you can do 20 things in a week and now you have 40 things that you need to do, well, it's probably going to take you about 2 weeks. And it sounds too simplistic to actually work, but to my surprise, it actually works pretty well.
Yeah. And particularly, like you said, when you have that longer view and when most other things are static, right? So like, you know, anytime you gain or lose a team member, right? Your team isn't actually staying the same. Like a lot of people say, like, you know, that's a new team, right? You may call yourselves the same thing, but you've got to go through all that process again. Or, you know, someone takes parental leave, right? And, you know, they're going to come back and whatever, but, you know, they're busy doing more important things right now, quite frankly. And understanding where those things are coming from can be very difficult, right? Or it can even just be like someone has had a bad couple of weeks because life has been hard for them, right? Like on the surface, everything is the same. What's driving this? And like at a very micro level, you can just drive everyone sort of nuts trying to figure out like, how am I going to optimize this very specific thing over this very small scale?
Yeah. Yeah. All that stuff is tricky. Okay, so we talked about, I want to recap a little bit, unless there was more stuff regarding process improvement. Obviously, there's a million more things about everything. But we talked about the leadership styles.
Yep.
And then we talked about, I don't remember what. What did we talk about after that?
Talked about different competitive advantage strategies and how That's we right. can use that to know how our company is perceived in the marketplace, and also how internally we can use that information to make some decisions about, you know, the easiest example is a build versus buy decision, or any other sort of levers we can pull to know how the organization is going to move forward in a particular strategy.
Are you talking about physical levers that you could find in like a janitor closet?
You know, I don't know if they'd be there, because a lot of like the mop handles like could accidentally like push them or pull them. Mm-hmm.
But, oh, yeah, no, sometimes they're like concealed like that. They're disguised. You think it's a broom handle, but it's really this like thing that makes the wall like rotate around. And it's this whole secret chamber.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I haven't come across that yet. I would love to. To answer your question seriously, I was just speaking metaphorically about the...
yeah, I was just trying to make one of my hilarious jokes.
But
yeah.
But yes, I would... That would actually be like really great to work at a place and just know like, oh, we need more energy, you know, in my presentation style, time to turn the dial.
There you go. Yeah. You can go like to their library bookshelf and just individually like pull on each one of the books to see if it's like a secret trigger.
So yeah. Like, just like taking sconces off and turning lights on and off and yep.
Yeah. Going through your boss's desk looking for a secret button to a trapdoor. Anyway, Kevin, this has been great, and I think it's been educational. Where can people go to find more about you online?
Sure. So I'm on Twitter at Kevin_J_M. My website is kevinjmurphy.com, and you can find out more about the NAR company at thenar.co, and NAR is spelled G-N-A-R.
We'll put all that stuff in the show notes, of course. Kevin, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.